Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me successfully?
Yeah.
Thank you for coming here today to listen to us, and thanks in particular to UBS for letting us use the facilities. I have to confess, I haven't been to the repository for a time. I hadn't realized quite how difficult it is to get here nowadays, but I hope everybody managed. So, the point of today, or aim today, sorry, is really to introduce some new people, including me, to you. A number of people won't have had the chance to meet me or the new chief executives, so part of the point is to do that. Dermot Durbert, the new chief exec, will give us an update on the major issues on our agenda at the moment, and then we've taken the opportunity to combine this with our announcement of draft determinations on the electricity distribution review, ED1, which we announced this morning. And so we'll run through the two presentations, and then we'll have a panel Q&A session where we'll also have Rachel Fletcher, who runs the markets division, with us. I'm just going to say a couple of things, one about personnel and the other just about the general environment we're in. So first of all, personnel. This slide has probably changed quite a bit since a number of you saw it. It shows you the authority and then the senior management team. So I arrived as chairman last October. Dermot Nolan joined us in March as chief executive. Andrew Wright, who had a spell as acting chief executive, is now finance director, as you can see on the chart. And we two other people left, Ian Marley and Hannah Nixon, to both of whom we were very sorry to lose them and very grateful to them for all of their contributions while they were at Ofgem. But following on from that, as I said, we now have Rachel Fletcher running the markets division, Martin Crouch, who isn't here, running transmission in the networks area, Maxine Flerk has recently stepped in to run distribution and will see through the ED1 process. And then Sarah Harrison is still responsible for the Sustainable Development Division, and Bob Hull is running ESERV, the very large bit of Ofgem now that runs programs, environmental programs, etc. for the government. The non-executive board, the names in the slightly yellowish shade, is unchanged since about 18 months ago when we last appointed two newcomers to the board. So it's quite a turnaround, but it's a very good team that I'm very happy with. The number of people I still know from last time I was at Ofgem, which is always encouraging. So turning to the world at large, just the general context, I suppose. A year ago, pretty well, when my appointment was announced, I knew it was going to be an interesting job, but I probably hadn't realised quite how interesting in some respects the first year would be. Even before I started, we had the Labour Party conference, the price freeze, the pledge to abolish Ofgem, and then the whole debate just kind of exploded through the autumn with price rises and so on. And as a result, we've been in a world of intense political scrutiny, media scrutiny, general dissatisfaction with the industry, with the companies, with the market, and frankly with us. And it's been quite a difficult operating environment. In the background, you have the increasing involvement from Europe in the energy sector. In particular, at the moment, the development of network codes, which we need to reflect in our regime. And of course, in the background, we have the elections coming up next year, and rather nearer term, we have the Scottish referendum. So it is a very complex environment, and I think we just have to accept the degree of political, media, public scrutiny just to continue and possibly even increase in the 9 months through to the election next year. But actually, in many ways, none of that changes what we do as a regulator. We have statutory duties which drive pretty much everything we do. Primary duty to protect the interests of consumers, and an important role in providing a stable regulatory regime which should help to foster a stable investment climate, which is particularly important in a period when you've got the kind of frenetic debate about the sector that we have going on round about us. So we will carry on focusing very much on doing that job, protecting the interests of consumers in amongst all of this. And that's what we're going to talk about today, starting with Dermot Nolan, Chief Executive, who will take us through the main issues on our agenda across the piece, and then Maxine on the distribution review.
Thank you for that, David. Now, see if I can get this slide gesture to work. Yes, excellent. So thank you again. As David said, thank you very much for coming here. My name is Dermot Nolan. I'm the new CEO, newish CEO at this point. I've been in the job 4 or 5 months, so somewhat shorter time than David, but this was my first time seeing any of you. I can't really spell my name, but that's probably that's come to the risk of having some bizarre Celtic terminology. So in any case, what I plan to do, I think, over the next 10, 15 minutes, it's probably about 15 minutes, about 6 or 7 slides, but what I want to give you is some sort of sense of what are the major areas Ofgem is working on, what will be its major foci of interest over the next 2 years. I'm going to pass, understandably, go through markets, networks, and then lead in, if you will, to the Rio price control, at which point Maxine will give you far more detail about the nature of the announcements we proposed this morning. So before doing that, I just want to say one other thing, which is that we're very much committed to being more open about our strategic focus, our strategy. Later on this year and early next year, we will come to propose a new Ofgem strategy, give a clear objective, sense of objectives, new work plans based on that. So we're trying to revitalize that. So what I'm hoping to give you is a sense of within that, against that background, what areas will we be concentrating on? Okay? So I'm going to start with something that perhaps is unsurprising because it's perhaps the most single talked about issue in energy at the moment, which is the investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority. I presume you all know the background, but just to be absolutely clear, the Competition and Markets Authority itself is a new entity that was created from the bones of the Competition Commission and the Office of Fair Trading. But by and large, the CMA aspect that we are referring the market to is essentially an extension of the Competition Commission. It's essentially the same, slightly different set of people, but the same kind of framework, the same process, and they will be drawing on the way in which Competition Commission investigations have proceeded in the past, in a way that I hope is well understood by investors, predictable, and will yield an answer in a defined period of time. So what's not on that slide is why we referred. I don't want to belabor the point overly because we put out extensive documentation on it, but we essentially referred the market for, we thought, good reasons. We referred it for good, strong, we thought, empirical reasons that the market, the energy market broadly defined, were not working effectively for consumers. We felt that the problems with competition had been there, or there were sustained, there were persistent problems with competition. We felt we documented a lot of evidence in that regard. As a result, we felt it had clearly and very clearly met the basic test required for a reference. And that only was the primary reason, was the reason we referred. Now, there are other issues attending upon that which we believe may give some benefits to the sector, to the public, the entire energy debate, in the sense that we certainly hope, and I would be reasonably open about this, we certainly hope that it will help to depoliticize the issues about energy and give and a thorough and independent examination by a body that is frankly very well understood, that I think is trusted by investors, and that was a perceived side benefit. So I shouldn't disguise the fact we referred the market because we thought we were a problem. Just in terms of the material on the slide and the investigation itself, the standard Competition Commission, and indeed now CMA, mode of investigation will be to identify features that it believes would have an adverse effect on competition, and then if they are there and they test that idea, then provide remedies for them. Then obviously if there are remedies, the remedies are further tested, and then indeed any final decision is subject to appeal to the Competition Tribunal and ultimately the court. There's something that are characteristic to the energy sector, which I won't belabor on the grounds you're probably all relatively expert in this issue. But one thing I do want to finish on before going to the next slide is what to expect from Ofgem during this investigation. So this process will take 18 months minimum, maybe 2 years. It's already started. The CMA has put something out in that regard. We will not be just doing nothing. So even in the markets area, I want to make that very clear, we will not be doing nothing. We have ambitious plans, which I'll come to in a second, to try and make the market better for consumers. But within the confines of the market, of the CMA investigation, we will be another participant within it. And it's an independent body, so we don't have any special legal relationship with them. But we'll be tracking and reporting on developments in competition over the course of the investigation. We're doing another state of the market next year. We're going to be doing such a report every year. So that will be available for the CMA for next March or April. We'll also be submitting evidence and offering the CMA whatever expertise we can, and hopefully we have some expertise, analysis, and information throughout the process. So in that sense, we'll be trying to assist them. We will not be trying to direct them where to go. It's their decision. It's five independently appointed experts making their own decisions, their own judgments, based on the evidence they've gathered. Nonetheless, we will be participating now. So, moving on. The first slide we're going to look at is market overview. That's a slightly dizzy slide, the diagrams are all over the place, but I suppose what I want to say is that the first bullet point, the main focus, as indeed relates to our statutory objectives that David has referred to, the main focus is to improve markets today, but also markets for the future. And that's to do so against the backdrop of what we believe will be pretty significant change in the energy sector. And much of that change will come partially because of the move to decarbonization of the energy sector and the electricity market reform, which I'll come to briefly, which I'll come to in a couple of minutes, but also because of changes in the retail market, and in particular, what we would call, for want of better words, the smart metering, the smart grid revolution, maybe too strong a word, but nonetheless, the sort of pattern, the major changes that will come into the market because of smart meters and because of smart grids. So that would be the idea. A lot of our work over the next few years in the retail and market space will be preparing for that. Preparing for that in the retail space, and also preparing for the changes in terms of renewable generation, far more intermittent generation coming on, that kind of space in the generation space. So the diagram, which I'll just look at briefly, looks at, so on the left we have security of supply, actions will be taken to improve that, including what's delightfully titled the electricity balancing significant code review. But nonetheless, it's basically something to bring us to facilitate more flexible generation to back up all the renewed intermittent wind generation. Then we've got further interconnections, smart meters in the middle, which will hope improve security supply by reducing demand. And on the right, we have the liquidity measures that are currently in place, the retail market review that is currently in place, and REMIT obligations, which I'll come to in a second. So by and large, a lot of our work in markets will be giving further incentives for new investment, and particularly to facilitate security supply, enhance security supply, and also obviously to promote competitive and well-functioning markets. But as I said, this is against the background where we say markets are not static. They will change. At the very least, they will change because of smart metering and smart grids. There may be all kinds of other changes we haven't anticipated as well. And one thing I want to try and be clear about is Ofgem is seeking to foster innovation in markets. We're not trying to stand in the way in that regard. We don't entirely know how the market will play out, but one key thing we're keen to do is foster innovation, things that will benefit consumers now and in the future. Okay, security of supply, which has been obviously an issue much discussed recently. And I think the Secretary of State and Ofgem itself and various other entities have said, I think fairly clearly, hopefully definitively, we believe the lights will stay on. So I would strengthen, I would again enunciate that particular message. Having said which, we've done a capacity mechanism, sorry, capacity assessment, sorry, according to their capacity assessment earlier this year, which said margins are tight, no question about that, they're down to 2.8%. Not so much for this winter, the more perceived and more problematic winter is the winter after next. But that's based on hugely careful examination done by both us and by National Grid and by DEC itself of the various energy scenarios and lots of sensitivities in that regard. So certainly there are tightening margins, very clearly so, but we believe the light will stay on. And some of the measures taken to ensure they will stay on are the following. One, we in National Grid, but particularly us, well, we have given tools to National Grid to use demand-side balancing and other balancing measures in the short run. And these may come into effect over this winter and more pertinently next winter, but they're essentially a mechanism for the next 4 years to make sure that the grid has the flexibility to ensure power plants stay open and that these demands are demand-side measures to reduce demand at peak times as needed. So that's in some sense a short-run issue that's supposed to get us over the next few years, which we believe it will do, and will do so in a reasonably cost-effective manner. Then there is the Department of Energy and Climate Change capacity mechanism. which is to stimulate medium-term investment, primarily in thermal plants, notably gas. And as you will have seen, that we received state aid clearance relatively recently from Brussels, and they're committed to having the first auction by the end of this year, in fact, before the end of this year. So that's the short one, that's the medium one. I referred earlier to the balancing code review. What this is doing is trying to give better incentives for flexible generation plants. So at least have more and more intermittent generation through offshore or onshore wind, but we couple that with gas and coal generation, there will be a need for plants, if you like, in the middle of the work, which is greater flexibility. And in that sense, we're committed to using market mechanisms where possible, and we believe this code review will give that kind of incentive for new plant entry to take place in that regard. And finally, in security supply, we'll be continuing to work both ourselves and in partnership with the government and with National Grid on further energy efficiency issues. Peak demand in the last 9 years has fallen by over 10%, which is, I think, quite a striking figure. Admittedly, we have gone through something of a recession, but our figures suggest that's not the primary driver, that energy efficiency measures are having an effect, and we'll keep with that work. We're also committed, I think, to trying to do more on demand-side response, again, working ourselves and partnering with the government to try and stimulate both industry and consumers to take demand-side response measures as part of everyday life, not as some sort of emergency measure, but to see it as part of the solution to ultimately controlling energy demand and energy costs. Okay, moving on, I'm going to come to this slide relatively briefly, because it is in some sense not an off-gen slide, but I think we thought it would be remiss to say nothing about it. This is the electricity market reform that is now law, or the vast majority of this law, and is emanated from the Department of Energy and Climate Change. This is again the background of a project that Ofgem kicked off 5 or 6 years ago, Project Discovery, as it was called, which talked about the trilemma, the issue of how do we balance the various different demands of security of supply, of keeping the lights on, of affordability, against a continued consumer anxiety about rising bills, and also the need, the perceived need, an actual need, and policy requirement to decarbonize the economy. How do we balance this trilemma? Not my favorite phrase, but it's not the most solicitous use of English, but it seems to be in the lexicon now, so we'll continue to use it. But in some sense, the electricity market reform is a response to that. And there are a number of aspects of this, including the carbon floor price, which I won't go into here. You could argue, I'd say, there are two main aspects. One is the capacity market. The DEC, as I said earlier, has received state aid clearance from Brussels. That's designed to stimulate thermal investment, predominantly in gas, nearly all in gas. I think it is unlikely there will be new coal investment, to be quite candid. But again, that is supposed to stimulate that. The pre-qualification process is going ahead. The first auction will be by the end of the year. And that is, as I said, a way to bring on new thermal generation. The second is renewable generation, which is the contract for difference mechanism that DEC also received state aid approval for recently, but there are eligibility applications and, again, an auction and allocation by the end of the year. Now, these are DEC projects, they're government projects, but nonetheless, we will be working with DEC and with GRID in terms of the regulatory role, both as an appellate body to GRID decisions and to monitoring and, indeed, enhancing as necessary the rules of the capacity auction going forward. So, not too many more slides left, I think. The next slide is enforcement activities. I put this there because I think it was important to be candid about our enforcement role. Enforcement action by a regulator, by any regulator, energy, finance, water, whatever, it is important. It's important to be seen, to be present, that there's a robust and clear enforcement regime. It's important to incentivize energy companies to abide by their regulatory obligations. Perhaps to be even more succinct, it's there to provide ensure that energy companies treat their customers properly. Now, we have had a number of investigations in the past. Quite a few of them have concluded recently. In particular, there were waves of enforcement actions because of mis-selling, and they've broadly concluded. However, there are other enforcement actions on the books, so to speak, and there may be future ones. However, in the third bullet point, I put if necessary. I have no particular desire to take enforcement actions if they're not needed. I want to be clear about that. I'd much prefer not to. Provided there was a satisfactory level of standard of service, provided obligations were being adhered to, provided there was satisfactory compliance, and the industry is now trying to work with us more effectively on that, I would be totally happy not to enforce. However, as long as that isn't happening, we will be there, we will be enforcing, follow the hope we will be doing so in a way that is clear, that is stable. That doesn't mean there won't be changes to the regime over time that will be announced and made clear in advance, and that is broadly predictable. So, as I said, we're committed to enforcement, but we will do so, we believe, in a reasonable fashion. And two examples there. One is the REMIT regulation, the EU regulation on wholesale energy market integrity and transparency, where we are currently taking on new power to monitor wholesale market trades, to monitor that market and enforce as necessary. And finally, I wanted again to be clear about this, we have stated quite publicly a few months back that for any future breaches of licenses, and when I say future, that means from broadly about now, June to summer 2014, anybody found in breach, and I would say again, I want to be clear, we will not find someone in breach casually. We will do so. We've got an enforcement panel set up. We will go through every single reasonable safeguard and procedure before we find someone in breach. But if we do, we will have higher penalties, higher financial penalties in future than we've had in the past. So I think I wanted to be quite clear and open about that. So if there are breaches in the future for events taking place from now on, certainly not something that has been done in the past, we're not trying to arbitrarily increase fines halfway through a process. But for any behavior, any breach of license conditions in the future, there will be higher fines. I think I need to signal that. Okay, two more slides. The next is transmission. Where transmission being, if you like, one half of networks and distribution being the other, I wanted to talk a little bit about transmission by itself. The first point is interconnection, which again has been receiving a degree of attention recently. But I think it's probably fair to say, and that Britain is perhaps underconnected. You would have expected maybe to see more interconnectors and more investment in that area over the last 5-10 years, and we haven't, as it were. So what we felt is we wanted to stimulate interconnection in a positive way because it will clearly bring benefits to British consumers. It will enhance security of supply by connecting us to other markets, particularly markets where there may be cheaper wholesale prices. It should facilitate sort of lower prices as well. So we're trying to incentivize interconnection in a way that we haven't done in the past, in some sense. And we're changing the model. So we've proposed as a medium-term solution, cap and floor regulation, as we call it. And the idea with that is that we are providing a clear framework for investors to come into us with their proposals, and there will be further announcements about that in the next few weeks, and our window, if you like, in that regard. We're providing incentives for firms to do that. We're providing them with a cap and floor mechanism, where the cap is explicitly designed to protect them against downside risk. So what we're saying is, if you come in, make an efficient investment, we'll give you a downside protection. And we think that should enhance confidence in the system. We're obviously putting a cap in as well, but nonetheless, we feel this model will be a better way to stimulate interconnection investment going forward. Other areas, one is Project Transmit, which is the charging methodology by which sort of transmission is done. We've done a major project which is now concluded in that regard, which we think will give more efficient signals for future investments in generation and interconnectors. There's a project which will be an announcement about in September called the Integrated Transmission Planning and Regulation project. Again, we love our acronyms, ICPR. But broadly what this will be doing is we'll be focusing the role of the system operator part of National Grid, looking at that, seeing if that can be enhanced, trying to facilitate further on competition for onshore transmission projects. So can we, for major transmission projects, can we have a more competitive model, potentially competitive tendering model, that isn't currently there? So we'll be making an announcement about that in the near future. But I would stress, and again, I want to be very clear about this, that in no way unpicks or affects the price settlement with National Grid. It's more about the future and bringing perhaps competition to those areas. Finally, the strategic wider works, where we'll be looking in a particular regime for very large-scale transmission projects. And of course, there's offshore transmission, which is subject to competition, and where there's been significant investment, over about $1.5 billion has reached financial close. So again, we feel that offshore transmission system has worked relatively well. We'll be continuing to develop it and hopefully make it more efficient still. And finally, and a segue into Maxine's comment, the RIIO framework for network regulation. So the RIIO framework was set up because we believe it would drive benefits for customers. It was essentially very much in the area of incentive regulation. And again, within networks, the natural monopolies that we actually directly regulate the price, it's again a background of trying to provide companies with incentives, trying to give them incentives to outperform, to deliver output efficiently, to challenge them, but also reward them if they get things right, if they really outperform and deliver significant improvements. I saw my team being on various media outlets this morning. One thing we were saying, I was quite clear, is that over the last 25 years, network regulation, we believe, is a real success. It's been a real success story for Britain. So certainly in electricity distribution, the actual cost of running an electricity distribution network compared to 1990 when privatization occurred, they're now 39% lower than they were then. So I think it's a strong achievement, not necessarily for the regulator, but for the whole system, and in particular the companies themselves. We're very much committed to this system. We think RIIO will be good, it will be an improvement, because it will provide further incentives, it will provide further aspects of innovation, and slightly different behavior by regulators in providing things like the No Carbon Network Fund, etc. But by and large, we still think it will provide the transparent, very important, the predictable framework that rewards timely delivery, encourages innovation, and provides a clear and stable investment climate. That's broadly about it. Before handing over to Maxine, obviously I'll be there to answer as many questions as you might like to put to us. I want to stress again, Ofgem is basically acting, as we see it, and we think we are, in the best interest of consumers, both in the short run and the long run. That's our statutory objective. That's what we're committed to. But we're also committed to working with investors, to providing a stable environment, to preserving the model of independent regulation, to make decisions, necessary decisions, both in the short-run interest of consumers, but also in their long-run interest, and to ensure that the electricity and energy system is working effectively today, but also is working effectively in 10, 20, and 50 years' time from now. Okay, I'll pass over to my team now.
Thanks, George. So what I want to do today is talk briefly through the draft determination for RIIO that we published today. I'm going to talk about, firstly, going back a bit over the process and talking about where we started back in November with the fast track decision and what's happened since then. And then to talk a bit about where the conclusions from the scrutiny that we've given to the cost plans and what we've formed a view of in terms of the efficient costs that companies should be allowed. Talk a little bit about their ability to finance their activities. And then finally, as Dominic said, the RIIO structure is about incentives more generally, not just about efficiency, but about delivering good customer service. And so I'll say a little bit about that. As Dominic said, we've read out this morning on the media, and really our message about the package as a whole is that there's some very significant investment that we're allowing through in the company's business plans, some tough targets around improved customer service, but all of this being achieved at a lower overall cost for consumers. So I think what we're saying is really very much a tough but fair settlement, and it's good for consumers, which should also deliver the returns that investors need. So if we wind back to last November and what we called our fast track process, which is designed to get companies to come forward with the best possible business plans that they can early in the process to kind of really try and help us get better information on which to set stretching targets for them. And at that stage, we were judging all of the company's plans against five criteria: their process in terms of engagement with stakeholders, the outputs that they were delivering in terms of customer service, their efficiency on costs, their financial assumptions, and the ways that they were planning on handling uncertainty and risk. And as you can see from that picture, we were kind of marking them all red, amber or green, depending how well we thought they'd done, and we had a fairly mixed bag across the piece, with WPD as the one company that scored green across all five categories, and that was what led to WPD being fast-tracked through, and basically then getting the business plan that they put forward to us. Since then, the companies have all resubmitted their plans and have made significant additional savings. So £700 million worth of savings in the difference between the slow track and the fast track and the slow track plans, really demonstrating the way that RIIO works to incentivise the companies to come up with good plans for us. And in all of the other areas, so process and output and handling of uncertainty and risk, all of the companies are now showing green. So they've all put in much more justification into their plans and really stepped up to the mark, kind of competing with each other to put forward the best plans that they can. So the two areas where we needed to carry on scrutinising the plans, and we've always made clear that the flow track process will involve us going through that much more detailed scrutiny, is around the costs and then on the financing side, which is therefore what I'm going to focus on in what I say now. So in terms of our view of the efficient costs, we identified three broad areas where we felt the companies could make additional savings beyond what they had put forward in their plans. The first was the kind of conventional benchmarking work that we do, doing lots of modelling, whether it's a top-down model or a bottom-up disaggregated model, and looking at it from different angles, looking at the best that each company has to offer and benchmarking them against each other. And out of that kind of quite conventional process in terms of price control methodology, we identified $650 million of savings that we felt the companies combined could have made in terms of our view of what sufficient costs would be. The second area was real price effects. So within a price control, we index the RAS to take account of RPI. So we don't expect to be able to forecast that. That's obviously an uncertainty. So the allowed returns are indexed linked to RPI. But obviously, a lot of the company's costs, particularly labour and some materials, may move at a different rate. And historically, over time, they've grown faster than RPI. So within the allowed TOTEX, we have an element called real price effect, which is effectively a measure of how much faster, or perhaps but how much faster typically, those other elements of costs have gone up than RPI. What we have here is the fact that since the companies put in their fast track plans, we've had updated figures. And no surprise to anybody here, things like real labour costs have remained low, if not negative. And so the state of the economy's latest figures should have us at a lower starting point than the companies would do in their projections. So although we've got the same kind of forward trend in terms of the difference between future labour rates and RPI, starting with the more recent figures plugged into our model gives us an additional $850 million of savings compared to what the companies were projecting. And then the final category is around smart grids and smart metering, where our view is that there is more that the companies could have been putting into their plans to take advantage of these changes in technology. We expect the world to look very different at the end of 8 years. We've rolled out smart metering to all homes and businesses by 2020, and a huge potential for companies to make much more use of smart grid innovations and technologies to avoid the need for reinforcement, for example. And in assessing that, we've based it on a range of industry models, the government's impact assessment for smart metering, industry models that they've been produced for other purposes rather than for the price control, but giving us a broad sense across the piece that there is more that could be done in this space. And on that, we've assumed another $400 million in our view of what an efficient network could achieve. So those are the areas where we believe that the companies could achieve more in terms of cost savings. Obviously, that's factored into the allowed revenues that we've given them at the end of the day. Obviously, what that means for different companies varies. I'm not going to talk in detail through that chart, but it was attempt to bring together on one page all the figures for you. Sets out their initial business plan at the fast track stage, what they submitted to us in their revised plans, so they gave some savings of, I was putting $700 million, that's about right, and then the allowed draft termination allowance, which sets out what we are proposing in terms of allowed revenue for those companies. Which is $1.4 billion less than they were putting forward in their business plans. Obviously, that varies between the companies. Some have been more ambitious in their plans that they've put to us and have had smaller cuts as a result. But that's the broad picture. So turning now to the financing side, The cost of equity, what we've confirmed today is really just a confirmation of the minded two position that we put out in February, of a 6% post-tax real cost of equity. That is consistent with what came out of the Competition Commission's investigations in Northern Ireland and electricity price control, which was confirmed by the CMA in April. So that gives us a fairly solid base of how the CMA as a fuel body would look at this kind of decision were it to refer to them. We would have to adjust for our own situation. But so we remain confident and sticking with our 6% cost of equity. The area that where we've made what's probably quite a significant change since our November decision is on cost of debt, which we have been proposing to use a 10-year trailing index, intended to effectively say what we're looking at here is the long-term cost of debt, and that was what we've done in T1 and GD1. We had a lot of pushback from the companies that said this simply didn't reflect their true cost of debt, and in particular, you know, the term of debt for distribution companies is an average of 21 years, and therefore the kind of 10-year trailing index was not giving them a fair cost of debt for their actual position. So what we've done is looked at that again, and what we're now proposing is what we call a trombone. So it will start as a 10-year index, but will extend out by 1 year every year until we get to 20 years. So it will continue to give weight to those earlier years, 10 years ago, which is expected to reduce the volatility in that index. And we believe that's really important for the companies, both in terms of giving them a better reflect their actual cost of debt, and also it reduces the interest rate risk that they face should interest rates continue to fall or to remain low over the coming years. So that may not be going quite as far as some of them would have wanted, so we're looking for us to start our index at 15 years and then from ban out to 20 with some of the proposals that we received. We believe that would have over-provided for their cost of debt. But this, we believe, is a fair response to that particular challenge around making sure that across the sector we are giving a cost of debt that properly reflects the cost to the companies. I feel this is linked to the fact Ofgem has a duty around financial stability that we take very seriously. As Dermot said, we are here. Our principal objective is to protect the interests of consumers, but we also have a very important duty around financial stability to ensure that licence holders are able to finance the activities which are the subject of their obligations. And that is something that weighs very heavily on our minds in setting price controls. But also because we do believe it is in consumers' interest, ultimately, that they are able to finance their activities and get timely access to finance in order to be able to invest as they need to meet customers' requirements. So what historically Ofgem and other regulators have tended to do is to look purely at a set of the kind of rating agency metrics based on the idea of a notional company, a notional efficient company with a notional gearing and assuming that it meets the cost targets that have been set. What we've done for this review is to go further than that, to really test the financeability of our proposal by looking at the company's actual cost of debt, by looking at different interest rate scenarios, by looking at the impact of different levels of underperformance potentially, in order to really test that we can be confident that what we are doing is not pushing those companies too far. And the conclusion of our modelling, looking at the range of metrics from the rating agencies and from carrying out that analysis, we remain confident that all companies can finance their activities, that all companies are capable of maintaining the investment grade credit rating that they're required to maintain under the terms of their licence. I mean, in some cases, if you put it through the model, we could end up with up to the one notch downgrade in some of those ratings, but nothing that fundamentally affects financial ability. There's one company, E&W, for whom the pressures of underperformance would be more challenging. And for them, clearly what we have always said in relation to price controls, it is the responsibility of the company to sort out their capital structure. What we've done on the debt index will help companies like E&W who have a high cost of embedded debt. And we have also made clear that, as always, companies can request changes to the revenue profile, request NPV neutral changes to the way in which the revenues flow through in terms of fast money, if that helps give them the space in which to think about their capital structures. So very much for the companies, but overall our conclusion is that the proposals that we are putting forward are financeable by the companies. Moving on now to what I said at the beginning was Rio isn't just about money, it's about customer service and output and innovation, Rio Tinto. But obviously the way that we drive that is through incentives, but at the end of the day it does all come back to money. What this rather rainbow coloured chart is about, and I'm not going to expect you to look at every single bit of it, but the sort of middle bit between the two kind of ready coloured bits is about the range of return on regulated equity that a company could get if its efficiency performance was within certain bounds. But then there's a large number of different incentives that sit on top of that around interruptions incentives, what we do on losses, customer satisfaction measures, connection performance, which are all those different shades of green, pink, orange and yellow, which cumulatively show the opportunities that are there for companies to outperform if they're able to meet and strive against all of those incentives that we put in place. There is space there for the companies to earn significantly higher returns if they are able to do well against all of our outputs and incentives, which is good for customers, but then makes it good for the companies and good for investors. So the aim of that chart is to give you a sense of the whole range between what a company might achieve if it really outperforms, both in terms of efficiency and customer service, and then the downside risks that the companies face as well. So that they are aiming to ensure that the companies, if they get into serious trouble, they are still not far short of covering their cost of debt, but for top performing companies, if you can really achieve a top on efficiency and top end performance against all the customer service incentives, the opportunity remains, as we've said previously, to earn double-digit returns. So that was really a kind of ED1 draft determinations in a nutshell. Where we are in terms of next steps, this is a consultation. The consultation closes in September and we will announce our final decision in November, with that price control now coming into effect from April. With the first year of revenues actually being set on the basis of the decision we've published today, but clearly if we change our position on any of those measures, that will be recouped in future. So that is simply to allow the suppliers to have the certainty about what the first year's charges will be. It doesn't actually ultimately affect the revenues, the revenues that the companies will get. And then we have committed going forward to a much more transparent process of annual iterations and monitoring so that investors and others can see, as we go through the price process, how the companies are doing against the various targets and measures that we have set out. So we will now set the stage. Thank you.
Well, we are unusually, in my experience, the kind of events will see the presentation sooner than we were meant to be. So we have plenty of time for questions and answers. Could I simply ask you to, when asking a question, to say who you are, and I have a note to myself to remember that there are a number of people listening in my phone, and I will at some point break and ask the questions from the conference call. As well as the four of us on the panel, we have in the front row here Andrew Wright, plus Anna Lossington and Ian Ralston as well in the ED1 team. And if we get into particularly detailed discussion of bits of ED1, I might just ask you to take
ended up in there afterwards, but we'll see how it goes. So, what are your questions? Sorry, there are microphones.
Thank you. Dominic Nash, Macquarie. I have two questions, please. The first one is on smart meters. It looks like you've put through quite a large innovation cost reduction, which may or may not materialise. I suspect against the company's baselines. First sort of part of that is, why should the IQI score reflect an innovation change, or is it a way that you should actually sort of rebase? And secondly, is National Grid also going to benefit materially from the smart meters, and are they going to have that reduced in their baseline as well? I suspect not. And the second one on ROEs, I think in your financial document you said that the cost of debt from bone mechanism potentially reduces the cost of equity as it reduces the risk to equity, and at the high end of the ROE. Can you confirm that the ROE we see today will not be reduced going into the final determinations in November?
So your first one on the smart benefits, in particular on the IQI adjustment, and we have made an adjustment to the IQI to make sure that two of the companies did receive something positive out of the IQI adjustment. So there is a recognition that we can't say that all companies are underperforming unless we're not given anything on IQI.
But it's more sort of a philosophical point that this is kind of like an innovation that I think even your own words, we don't know what the world's going to look like in 8 years' time. So how much of the total innovation did you strip out of your sort of baseline?
So we have, the figure that we have put there is our judgment about what is a reasonable amount. So we could have put in a higher figure if we'd been really ambitious. This is based on looking at the DEC impact assessment to justify smart metering. It's looking at industry's own transform model that they used to develop with the Smart Grid Forum. So there's a sort of a reasonable amount of, a lot of this is industry's own numbers, but as I said, put forward for different purposes. It's challenging. In any price control, there's a sort of an efficiency assumption going forward that's based on what you can get out of innovation. So we believe that this is something that the companies can achieve, otherwise we wouldn't be putting it forward.
And
National Grid, I think there's greater savings on the electricity distribution side than there are on gas or in the transmission networks. Those
price controls
are settled anyway.
Yeah, we're not touching National Grid price controls. I've probably said that many, many times, but you can probably assume that I'm saying it at any given point in time.
And then on the cost of debt, as you say, rightly, so an element of that reducing the risk, which could lead you to say there's more headroom in the cost of equity. Our proposal is that we're sticking with our 6% cost of equity. That's out for consultation. I can't absolutely guarantee that nothing will move my final proposals, but at the minute that's very firmly our proposal, and there is no reason now to shift from it.
Jamie Cunningham from Redburn. You sort of mentioned, I think, that given what happened with the company sort of upping their game, that WBD now looks less efficient. And I think you argued that that's really worth it because of those changes you extracted from the rest of the pack. Where would you reach a point where you've given so much to someone in the fast track that it becomes unacceptable? Because I just don't have a feel for that. You basically make this nice sweeping statement that it's fine because everyone else did enough, but where's the point that it would be something that is unreasonable?
I'm just going to briefly on that. I mean, again, the fast track, slow track system is designed in some sense to bring competition to the process of profession. I don't think that suits any of that. Because people are encouraged and incentivized to bring plans early, to bring the most efficient plans early, to avoid what can often happen in sort of network regulatory price reviews, of refusing to show your hand initially and going through a long, complex process with the regulator. So there's an explicit reward. And I think we want, again, want to be candid about that. There's an explicit reward if you brought in a business plan that's designed for consumers, makes clear efficiency gains, and is acceptable to the regulator. So they will get that reward. And again, it's almost a National Grid thing. That's settled. That price control is now determined. The period for appeal has passed. we're not going to reopen that. In terms of, it clearly will get a benefit as a result, and that's fine. Future price control, we hope, again, in a dynamic process, because there will be future price control somewhere away, but they will happen. And again, you hope that over time that will incentivize companies to bring to the table things much earlier, seeing that there is a reward from fast track, and as a result, trying to get that fast track too.
So you're basically saying there's no cumulative sort of differential between, you know, something that's locked in and, you know, what's happened now is seemingly quite a big difference that you see as, you know, a concern. You basically say that's a deal. Now it looks as though, you know, cumulatively all those things you gave them has created a very, very big difference. And you're not worried about that.
I'm saying it's a deal. I'm saying in that sense it's a done price control at National Grid.
Yeah. And of course, one of the aspects of the way we do regulation is that you learn from things and you apply those lessons next time around. And, you know, that's what you did.
Yeah, that's both the companies and yourself.
Hmm?
That's both the companies and yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, Martin Griffin, Deutsche. It's kind of a follow-up to that. One, just on the technical point about whether this is a done deal with WP, has the statutory consultation period actually finished? Because I thought it was going to run at the license control consultation was at the same time as the Stokehart one, but I may be wrong. But in terms of the quantum, I mean, it looks like their starting point before TOTEX incentives is maybe 150 basis points higher on equity, and then because the real price effects have been introduced only for the slow track ones, I mean, maybe another 50 basis points plus on that. 8-year price control, you're talking about 16% of regulated equity. It's a big number. It's a big carrot for being in the fast track.
I took the non-trivial number, but again, there's probably not much more I can say other than that the deal is done. We will learn from it, other companies will learn from it, but it's very much done. On the specific deal period, correct?
One more from this particular room, then we'll move on.
Evan Reese from Lazarus. Two questions. Firstly, you sort of talked in the document about financeability, and you mentioned that quite a number of the companies under your modelling are sort of marginal in terms of investment grade credit rating. But from memory, on your index, you use a fairly comfortable investment grade credit rating. I was wondering how you square those two things. And then secondly, how are you confident that any network savings will be passed through to customers?
So I think on the first one, I'm not sure which text you picked up on, but I mean, I don't think we raise any questions in the document about them maintaining investment credit rates. So I think we might say some of them have difficulty with PMICR, but that is only one element that the rating agencies look at. And, you know, so across the piece, we would maintain our position that, you know, they are all capable of maintaining that investment credit rate
Would you say that, I might have misread it, but it sounded like a lot of the companies were fairly marginal. I mean, it's close, but you feel that comfortable that they can maintain it, but it doesn't feel like it would be a comfortable investment grade rating. It doesn't feel like it would be an A-minus A rating. It would be...
So I think what we've said is that our modelling would suggest no more than a one wash downgrade. So that still leaves most of them a couple of notches above. I think what we've said is we want to really make sure that we are looking at that carefully, which is why we've done all of the additional different sort of analysis around financeability, but we're not saying we've got worries about them being anywhere near losing investment grade.
Okay, so you think it's consistent with A minus triple D plus at this level?
I think what we're saying is that it's consistent with investment grade rating, and that there's, like for nearly all of them, there's at least a few notches they could go. They could go down one, but we certainly don't anticipate anyone is going to go down to junk. We really don't.
Okay. And so
I'm not saying definitively A minus, but I'm saying consistent with investment grade rating.
And on your index tracker, what are you assuming for credit rating?
I'm not sure I know.
Okay.
terribly, I mean, we might, if it's okay, we might come back to that at the end. I apologize for that, but we'll specifically come back to you at the end. I was going to answer your second question, which was, am I confident it will be passed on? I have no guarantee it will be passed on. We don't regulate retail prices. We have no plans to regulate retail prices. So our basic role in this regard will be to bring as much transparency to the process as possible and to rely on the process of competition. So I can give you no further answers than that, but I certainly would hope it will be passed on.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Lakis, I'll ask you two questions on the price control and one on outside the price control. First one is a very general one. Do you have any niggling concern that you're still giving too high allowed returns, but you're just backing into a number to allow you to maintain flexibility, which by your own admission, you're hard on that limit at the moment. And that the reason you're there is that you've essentially, as regulators, not just you, but other regulators, sleepwalked into too high gearing assumptions, which you can't legitimately back down from. Do you have any concerns on that? And second question is something I think you'd agree that you've performed busily on, and that's annual reporting. But there really is a massive dislocation between what companies you put under IFRS and what the numbers are for regulatory purpose, and are you going to move on that front to do something like Ofwat does, which is have the companies publish annually a full reconciliation of the IFRS numbers back down, or UK GAAP, maybe have it put back down to IFRS? And the third question, outside, is you've really been going your feet on the CESP CERT penalties investigation. Can you give any colour on that, or when
we'd
expect something to come out on it?
I might take the third question first and then pass it to Maxine. Frankly, no, in the sense I can't comment on enforcement actions, and I'm afraid I just can't do that. All I can say is we're trying to progress all of them as rapidly as possible. I know that's not a perfect answer, but I'm afraid it is. I cannot comment specifically on it. Just before passing to Maxine, I'll say we have niggling concerns. We always have niggling concerns. Regulators go to sleep at night with niggling concerns. So I couldn't deny at least the premise of that particular question. So I'll pass to Maxine to look at these. Rather not fair of me, but anyway, CEO's privilege.
So I think perhaps the way I would answer it is that it's obviously very much starched by looking at what we think we can take out of the cost, say, and you know, what we can do with the RPEs, and then we check the financeability. So I don't think we would say that we were forced back into not being as aggressive, if that was your question.
I'm talking specifically about the allowed return, not about the cost assumption, not at all about the cost. I.e. that you're backing into a number for purely for flexibility reasons, and you're ending up with too high allowed return. We can't really see it in the electricity distribution companies, but we'll certainly see it in RAV-based companies that are still listed.
So okay, our main consultation around the cost of equity was earlier in the year, and we were looking at it from a number of different perspectives, and we looked at what came out of the Competition Commission, MSD, now the CMA. So I don't think that we feel backed into a corner on looking at financeability and really bottom up looking at capital and everything else.
I think the regulatory push to cost of equity is something you shouldn't change very often. The data doesn't change that rapidly, the circumstances can change that often. We've had the Competition Commission ruling on Northern Ireland. We've done a complete review of our views on the data, and we've arrived at a number that we feel comfortable with in principle. We're not there because it is necessary to make numbers add up or anything like that.
And then on your final one a bit about the annual reporting and the reconciliation, we are looking at what we're going to be doing going forward on the annual reporting, so we haven't yet finally settled exactly what the shape of that will be, but I understand the issue that you raised, and it's a good point about how we get a bit more transparency into that, as we've challenged over the last 2 days to kind of reconcile what some groups are quoting as the kind of reported accounting profits versus the way that we see the world. I think that reconciliation would help clarify some of that debate.
very special agency. It's not about the price control, it's about ITPR. Can you talk a bit more about what you're doing on that, because I'm not completely up to speed. And is this a way of, a backdoor way of trying to get an extra value out of transmission companies, given that you can't reopen their price controls?
I don't think it's anything subversive and disturbing in that regard. Firstly, there'll be something that will come out in September, which will say a little bit more about the results of our analysis. But broadly, I think what we're saying is the system currently probably doesn't work as well as it should in terms of informational requirements between the national grid, between the regulator, and indeed particularly given Grid's new enhanced role in EMR. So broadly, what we'll be doing with this is proposing a number of measures, which I can't go into detail now, but will be very much available to see in detail and discuss, if you wish, in September, which will say that going forward, we think a new kind of reporting mechanism, new mechanisms for major projects being potentially put into competitive tender, are natural outputs, which we will believe will enhance sort of grid performance, our performance going forward. What it is not, though, is not an attempt to cash extra money out of national grid. It really is. It's saying that going forward, the system operator needs to be functioning probably a little more effectively than it is now. And in doing so, we can potentially facilitate issues like large transmission projects, including onshore ones, being subject to competitive tender and potentially driving down costs as has happened offshore. So as I said, probably details will have to wait for September, but happy to discuss that now. But again, as I said before, it's not an attempt to suddenly extract more money from national grid.
ITPR is also just about trying to get some coherence into the regime, which has been developed as it stands from three different directions, one for onshore transmission, one for offshore, and another for interconnectors. And unfortunately, projects don't necessarily fall completely neatly into those categories, and it's a fair challenge for us to try to pull together a transmission regime which applies across the board, and that's part of the process.
Let's move to the back on this side. Hello, it's Mark Freshing from Credit Suisse. Two questions. Firstly, on the legacy losses incentive scheme, I understand there are some pretty big numbers involved, and I think one distribution owner has taken you to a judicial review. Can you give us an overview of the issues there and why you think you're right? And just secondly, on the cost of debt index, there was a clear handbook put out as part of the Rio process a few years ago. And since then, I mean, you've had the Scottish Hydro, the debt index has been changed for them. You're now moving to this 20-year trombone index. I mean, how robust do you think the original framework is if you keep on feeling the need to tweak certain key elements?
I'm going to actually ask Maxine to do the first and then David to do the second.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm observing the chairman's role as well.
I can only give a fairly high level view on the losses. So, I mean, losses incentive is going back to DP4, so that was a price control before last, where we had an incentive in the price control that had a kind of a mechanic incentive in it that was based on trying to measure losses and reward companies. We had a real problem with the data around that, measuring that incentive when we came to try and close out the price control because of adjustments that had been made to some of the data that was collected for other purposes. And our view of how best to make adjustments to those numbers in order to kind of give what we felt was a fairer figure for that loss of incentive to the companies is basically what's under dispute about whether or not we should have adjusted even further or not adjusted as much as we did. So that's what we're being challenged about, obviously, subject to a court hearing. So even if I knew more, I might not be able to say much more, but you know, that's basically the essence of it. And you're right, it's a reasonable sum of money for companies, but it's a sum of money that was in a previous price control that they signed up to, and you know, that's going back some time. It's just feeding through the process now.
I was going to say something on the debt index, because I don't think we're just chopping and changing, if you put it like that. I mean, the concept of using a trailing index approach to debt goes back into 10 years when we did it relatively informally.
the Rio process formalised that and chose an index so that everybody knew how it worked. And in the first two reviews, that index we thought worked pretty well as a measure of the needed revenue to cover costs and debt for the companies concerned. In electricity distribution, it doesn't work quite so well, and the 10-year index would have led to some structural under-recovery by the companies of perfectly sensibly incurred debt costs. The trombone more or less gets us back into a position where we think, across the piece, that debt costs are being properly covered by the allowance. It's not on a company-by-company basis, but across the sector, it does the job. And I think I'm probably more comfortable with the idea of the index going longer term, because essentially these are longer term businesses which will tend to take long term financing decisions.
But I mean, is it also fair to say that if it's company specific, or specific to a small number of companies, dealing with this right embedded debt premium, which is I think how Ofwat's dealt with some of its previous price controls, rather than potentially giving extra returns on equity at the back end to companies that are efficiently financed, do you think a one-size-fits-all approach is optimum here?
Yes. I mean, I don't think that, in principle, we should get into a business of trying to match each company's individual financing proposal, position. The way I tend to look at it is that the regulatory system, if you look at it from the point of view of a finance director who has been sitting there over a long period making individually sensible financing decisions over a period of years, should find that his debt allowance, broadly speaking, covers the cost of those decisions, and the sort of trailing index approach helps you get towards that position. On the other hand, the scope for people to do better than that or worse than that. And so taking a view on the type of allowance that will do the job across the sector retains the incentive effect for people to try to do better than that, which I think is a good thing.
Okay, thank you.
And down here, please. Sorry, yes.
Hi, this is Deepa here from Sanford Bernstein. I'm going to go back to the question on the ITPR. So I think initially you mentioned that this was going to be about the future. Could you be more specific about what time frame you're talking about? And I was just trying to reconcile in my head, you said this is not an attempt to reopen national gas price control or extract more money, but at the same time bringing in some competition. So would you just help me reconcile these slightly contradictory
statement? I don't think they're contradictory. I suppose in some sense I haven't perhaps provided you with great detail about ITPR, and frankly I'm probably not going to, simply because paper isn't out yet, and we'll be out more in September, and I'll be happy to discuss that analysis then. But as David said, it's trying to provide a coherence to the framework by which we look at large-scale transmission projects. And in particular, we'll focus on the role of sort of system operation and ensuring that we have a relatively effective and efficient system which decides where should major transmission projects go. Because, as I said, given the three regimes at present, we don't think there's enough clarity or commonality about it. So, as I said, that's probably all I can say now. I'm happy to talk with you about it again in the future if you need to. But I'll stress again, I don't think it's contradictory to say in any sense that this is not reopening of the grid's price control.
It's Ashley Thomas from SocGen. If I can squeeze in three questions with two follow-ups. On the WPD judicial review, you know, have you got a sense of timing? And then if they are successful, is it just a company-specific consequence, you know, i.e. the $110 million of penalties that have been allocated, you know, potentially reduces and costs to consumers go up, or is it potentially a wider industry consequence, i.e. you know, the net rewards that the other discos potentially get adjusted. The second follow-up was just on the ITPR, in terms of if we're having competition or potentially having competition for onshore transmission, you know, have you considered as to whether we should also have competition for a strategic wider works, you know, sort of offshore? And then my actual question, referring to slide 19 on the RORI ranges, you know, if I look at that, you know, sort of the broad range is sort of 2% to 11% RORI range, if I was to sort of overlay the proposed RORI range for the interconnectors cap on 4, you know, I think it's sort of 1.5 to 13. So for me, they actually seem relatively similar, whereas one is for a, you know, sort of fully regulated natural monopoly, and the other one's supposed to be a cap on floor, you know, where there is supposed to be a wider range.
Okay, well, I'll mention the ITP or common one, where we're not specifically looking at strategic wider work issues, but it's something that perhaps the government might want to look at in particular. Well, again, I can come back to you on that. On the issue of the cap and floor thing, I mean, the RORI range, as you said, if you take it from the very end to the very beginning, yes, it is a range that is broadly similar. But to be honest, these are extreme. I mean, one doesn't necessarily, the vast majority of companies, well, actually there aren't vast majorities of six, really, but, you know, we don't expect to see everybody down at one end or the other. We really don't. Most will be, for average performers, most will be in the middle. It's only the very exceptional performers who will get up towards the higher one, or the really poor performers who will get to the lower. So, and by itself, I don't regard this as inherently problematic for a range for regulated assets. And on the cap and floor regime, we think that the numbers that are being proposed will be of a certain degree of surety, because interconnectors can potentially, it's just really the cap on the floor. Interconnectors can get good returns if they build efficient investments. If they're used a lot, if there are significant differentials, interconnector owners potentially can make a huge amount of money. And that's fine. Zero problem with that. All it's really doing is saying, in return for the floor, because interconnector owners sometimes get worried about, well, suppose I build my interconnector, something happens, nobody uses it, I'm stuck with 40 for 40 years. We're just saying, we're giving you a baseline protection against that. And in return for that, we're going to limit your return, but we're going to limit it at a fairly high level.
And on the sale, and we don't know definitely the timing yet from the court, and we're assuming it'll be something like late towards the end of this financial year, in the court's hands. And then the question about whether it ends up just on UPD or more widely, obviously would depend on exactly what the courts decide, but we have very much said it has the potential to have implications for the decisions we've made for other companies. So we have highlighted that the other DNOs, potentially suppliers, could be interested parties, and has alerted them to that effect.
Thanks, it's Ian Turner from Exam. Can I ask a couple of questions? On your RORE range on slide 19, for the fast track company, what did you assume there about their performance versus the changes you've made today for the RPE and the smart grid? Is that on top of the returns here, or is that included in that return calculation? And then the slide right at the back, the appendix slide, can you just explain what the y-axis is on that? I'm a bit confused by that. I may see things a bit.
Heaven percent.
So I'll have a go, and I'll get my colleague or state to take a bigger because I'm giving the wrong answer. So I think on the first one, I mean, this is, were they to achieve the kind of levels of savings that we have set out for the other companies, this is the return that they earn. And the final one, this is the difference between what the index would show and their actual cost of debt. So what the first chart shows is that with a 10-year trailing index, for different interest rate scenarios, there is the potential for them to be a long way off their actual cost of debt. On the right-hand side, if you move to the trombone, in fact, all those lines are similar, so for a range of interest rate scenarios, we would be expecting them to earn fractionally less than their actual cost of debt, so they're sort of under-recovering very slightly, but they're not facing anything like that risk, or regardless of what interest rates do, they are pretty well in the same position.
Thank you,
Hi, following on from the team's question, and my very first one is kind of a little one, which is the smart meter innovation has come in. I think Ian was asking, are the WPD RORE inclusive of those or not, or has that a done deal? and these sort of extra innovative benefits on top of as the gas distribution and national grid. And the second one I've got to ask, I remember sitting here in a room not like this, I suppose, 18 months ago when we had the Rio transmission and gas distribution, we had a similar RORE chart. What are your thoughts about the results that actually came out of National Grid and SAC in the first year of the review where they're all at the top?
So I think the answer to the first one is the same as we go before. So this is assuming that they also hit those smart grid, if they achieve those smart grid savings, is what they need to achieve to get that.
We haven't reduced their TOTEX.
What we're saying is if they were going to be achieving the 12% return, that would be assuming that they were making those savings.
And on your view on the...
I don't know if I have a view necessarily apart from the fact that they are. Clearly in the first year they're performing well, and in some sense they'll be it. And I again will reiterate that that's the nature of a price control. They are performing well. Whether or not that whether that will be continued over the remaining 7 years of the price control, I don't know. But am I saying at the end of the first year, oh my God, I'm panicking, they're performing too well, we got wrong. Not saying that at all.
I mean, it's quite common for companies to do well in the first year of price control. I mean, they will tend to backload expenditure as sort of part of the incentive structure within a price control that you don't spend to hit the end year targets until you really need to. So they are doing well. It's not totally unusual for that to happen in the first year.
To move back, because I've been ignoring
Thanks. It's James Sparrow from BNP Paribas. Got three quick questions. Firstly, just clarification on slide 16 on the Northern Power Grid, the difference between that TOTEX and the DG. Does the 7.7% exclude that 61 million? So if you included that 61, it would be less. Secondly, just looking across the piece, looking at these differences between the plans and the TOTEX and the DG, can we find any sort of correlation between how big that divergence is versus where the price reductions come out and what the capitalization rate is? Or are we just kind of wishful thinking and that's kind of too simplistic to try and follow that thought process across the piece? And then finally...
Yeah, I was so busy trying to think about your first question. I missed you at the beginning of your second question.
In terms of trying to kind of benchmark basically how the companies are basically faring in this draft determination, can we see any link between how wide the divergence between the TOTEX they're asking for and the TOTEX they're being given, how big that is compared with how big the price cuts are up in the first year, or does that all get kind of powered by the capitalization rate in terms of the capitalization of their TOTEX? I suspect there isn't an easy answer to that one. And then finally, a very big picture question. There's been some stuff in the press about the CMA review potentially sort of moving to a big network. I'd just be interested in your comments on that.
I might start with that. In some sense, it's up to the CMA. They have the right, the legal authority to look at any aspect of electricity and gas supply prices that they wish. We indicated to them that we didn't think they should look at networks, that they were essentially monopoly activities. And I think they released relatively recently an issued statement, I think it was last week, Rachel can correct me if I'm wrong, which said that they didn't envisage looking at networks. So I don't imagine that they will, but they have the legal right to do so.
I just want to add anything.
I think there is something in their issued statement, actually, about electricity transmission charging, and we're certainly seeking clarity on that right now.
But the idea of price controls, no.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, on your MPG, the 61 million was something they put in as a sort of a fixed amount, and what we've done is put into an uncertainty mechanism. So, again, look at my colleagues, I think the 3172 thing has it out. So, if you put the 61 million back into their plan, then it's your bigger drop. But you know, sometimes we haven't penalised them having put that in. They didn't feature an IQI or anything else. We just sort of said, you put that in the wrong box, it should have been in the uncertainty mechanism. And then on the kind of how you compare between them, clearly what we're looking at here is a question of
the reduction against what they put in their business plans. So to some extent that also has a mix of, you know, how bold really they were in their plans and how ambitious they were in their plans, rather than necessarily who's done better or well in terms of what they might then expect to get in terms of returns going forward. So I think, you know, actually in documents there are lots of different comparisons. We've got the comparisons against the PID, against the current BP5 regime in terms of the level of step down against current revenues, which is another way of looking at it. So I guess I'm sure people in turn will look at this from all sorts of different angles. It's just one very crude way of just giving a sense of who might be most cross with this coming out today.
Right, I'm just going to pause and do what I said I would do, and so far I'm checking to see if there are any questions from the conference call. Not entirely sure how to do that, but...
For participants on the audio, if you wish to ask a question, please key star 1. I repeat, for telephone participants, please key star 1 to ask a question. I will let you know if there are any questions on the audio.
Firstly, around distributed generation and the growth of that, how does the price control take account of the uncertainty concerning the growth of distributed generation? And then secondly, it's kind of follow-up to my previous question and, around sort of retail prices, dermatology, that's obviously a very competitive market, or a competitive market that competition should deal with that. But clearly, Ofgem has referred into QCMA the SMI, which you produce would suggest that margins are increasing. You put together price control where there's potential decrease in network costs. You started the presentation by saying that you're not going to be idle while the CMA looks into the industry. So are you comfortable with your answer that the competition will lead to prices and
I'm not comfortable that directly will. I don't think I implied that. In fact, in the first sentence you said the idea that I said competition is working effectively. I don't think I said that, and if I had said it, it would be bizarre that I just referred, or we just referred the market to the CMA. So just to be clear about that, we don't think competition is working effectively at the moment. That's not to say it hasn't worked well in the past, and it's not to say that it won't work well in the future. I think we'd be fairly clear as an organisation that we're absolutely committed to the idea that competition, where possible, is the best way to give consumer benefits, as opposed to the short and long run. So we're very clear on that. So the idea is, however, I think we have assembled lots of evidence, and people made a basis, the supply companies made a basis, but we felt we've assembled lots of evidence to say competition isn't working very effectively at the moment. And ergo, we prefer the market. So that's why, as I said, I can't be comfortable that it will be passed along. I hope it will. I believe it should. And in any case, I believe a thorough review of the market, both for reasons of, you know, dry but hopefully informed analysis, which will actually hopefully lead to reasonable solutions and frameworks, but also to help rebuild trust in the sector, I believe that's the best way to make competition go forward. So I'm not comfortable it will be passed along. I believe it should be. But we're still genuinely committed to the model of competition we're on.
On the distributed generation side, I mean, clearly we've acknowledged that this is kind of one of the important trends that's the backdrop for this price control, but equally that it's one of the areas of huge uncertainty about exactly how fast the world will move. So it's one of the things we asked the companies specifically in their business plans to set out what assumptions they were making, and all of them are at the conservative end in terms of DEX, what they call the sort of slow list of the going green scenarios, but also ask them to set out how they would expect to respond if the world turned out very differently. So firstly, we were testing their ability to adapt if they needed to a very different environment, and then within the regime itself we have node reopens, so that if there is a very large increase in the amount of distributed generation load being put onto the system, then we can reopen price control and adjust accordingly. But so for the companies to think about how they would maintain that flexibility and be able to respond and
the ability within the Rubio framework to deal with that.
And how does that interact with the smart grid database? And so it's not like the things would be quite interesting.
So generally what we've looked at, the smart grid savings are based off all of the, we've looked at particularly all of the reinforcement that's needed, a lot of which is for this regeneration, but not all of it. Clearly, if you were in a more green scenario, there probably would be more opportunity for even more smart grid savings than we have put in. But again, you know, what we've allowed for in our modelling is an assumption that we're in the world that they are assuming that we're in is relatively low. Generation, but you know, there's no reason why you can't use those smart grid scenarios to avoid other kinds of reinforcement or even active replacement. We've argued probably not a huge large amount for that.
A couple of questions. One, you signaled the intention to increase the potential financial penalties if companies do things they shouldn't. How are you thinking about the rules of the group turnover as being a sort of overall limiting factor? How are you going to interpret that? I mean, if an oil major or a supermarket wants to enter the energy retail market and they're putting 10% of their group turnover at risk, you know, it seems to be quite a high potential risk for them to do that. So as you're thinking about expanding the scope of the fine, is there any guidance you can give to the kind of the clients at risk? And then the second question I had was on the capacity market and Ofgem's approach to dealing with that. So the first one is, if companies like applications are going above the price taker threshold and you have to sort of give pre-approval for that, how are you going to give transparency or consultation around that? Because you can't essentially come and say, we want to bid 35 on, and here's our sort of board approved document to prove that. You can't really go out to the market and say, they're going to bid 35. And then if companies do get approval for bidding above the price taker threshold, they then get a lower clearing price and they then don't close the capacity. Are you going to be chasing up some companies next year telling them you've got to take that capacity offline because the clearing price is below the bid you put in?
And then that's Richard if possible to the second one. The first one is a fair point. Now, like I say, we're increasing financial penalties. I think we gave some indicative comments and we may get further. We're certainly imagining increases. I'm trying to avoid pinning down too much, but instead of in the millions, it's more likely for significant things, it's more likely to be in the tens of millions. The idea that we would come next year to a 10% turnover for large companies, not really envisaged in any particular fashion. We're talking about fines for significant breaches that are likely to be in the tens of millions rather than going into the hundreds. I think it's a very fair point, though, and we may need to give a degree of guidance on that.
On the sectoral enforcement, the cap is 10% of their licensed entity turnover, not group turnover. So the different things apply to competition law, but the particular focus of our revised guidance is on sectoral license enforcement, where it's licensed turnover.
I think the approach here, because we also now have powers to order consumer redress, and the approach is, first of all, the company shouldn't be better off for having broken rules. And you try to use the redress mechanism to achieve that, and then you look at penalties as a possibly separate issue in the sort of way that Dermot described.
In terms of your question about capacity market and pre-approval, we actually haven't formalised our position just yet, but completely acknowledge some of the tensions that you flagged.
Just a quick question on interconnectors. Are you going to be putting safeguards in place when the caps and floors are being evaluated to ensure that the UK carbon tax isn't the sole or even the part driver of the attractiveness of such interconnectors?
I don't think we're coming. I'll have to come back to you on that in the sense that it's not immediately on the tip of my tongue what I should say, but I wouldn't have thought we would have put in specific guidance in that regard. We're not specifically looking at that. We see the basic idea of interconnected, apart from security of supply, which is obviously where we think there's a considerable benefit, is to facilitate trade between different cost regimes. And by and large, that's the way we care to look at it. I'll come back to you, if anything, one of my staff will come back to you on the issue of the carbon tax thing. But I don't anticipate anything specific.
Are you saying you don't have any, you, the uncertainty is about whether the principle should be there about whether carbon tax should incentivise trade or not, or is that definitely we wouldn't want to incentivise trade just because of the carbon tax, or is that uncertain?
It's probably not uncertain, but I'm not going to give you, I wouldn't want to give you a clear answer now and get it wrong, but I will promise I'll revert to you within the day.
Stephen Hunt from UBS. With respect to the CMA referral, and obviously you said that you feel the competition hasn't worked as well as you would have liked, is it purely a qualitative judgment, or have you done some quantitative work around it as well in terms of potential increased cost to consumers? And if it has, you have done this quantitative work, and if you back that back out with increased cost, where would retail margins have outturned over the last couple of years in a more efficient market?
We've done a lot of quantitative work, which is in our market assessment, which is, was published at the end of March this year, and is 180 pages of fun reading for you. Most of this data assembled is the econometric work, which looks at patterns of pricing behavior, looks at cost adjustments, particularly looks at whether or not when cost adjustments change, how much prices react in return. So we've done a lot of that. What we haven't done, and again, being clear about it, we haven't tried to look at a counterfactual and say, like, as a result of all of this, this is what prices would have been. Firstly, I don't believe it was in any sense necessary to meet the test. And secondly, it would have required a huge amount of investment time that perhaps the CMA will do. But so I would say backed up by strong econometric evidence that there was something wrong, but we haven't predicted margins in the sense we're not trying to do so.
Just one question on, you mentioned about the political rhetoric, etc. Do you think that Ofgem as a body should, I know you want to remain apolitical, but do you think you should be playing a greater role in trying to maybe inform and correct some of the more spurious comments that come out from the politicians?
Well, an interesting question. I might leave this to the chair of the... The fun of asking questions, the way.
This is the first one I've come across, but I thought this is a fair question. I think we should be actively in debate with the political parties. I think that should probably be going on in private with them. But I think this would be unhelpful if we weren't in active debate with people as they're coming up to the election and developing policies and so on. So I think our starting point is that Carlos and I are available and keen to have conversations with people, and we have been doing so. Sorry, what was the second?
So, have you had active debate with Labour on their price fees and informed them on your view on that?
We have had discussions with the Labour Party, and we will have more. I don't really want to go into any issue about what we've been saying or what discussions we've been having with each of them. We are talking to them across the board. But I think that's what we should be doing, but it should be something that we're doing quietly.
Thank you. It's Robert from the Hanson from Newton. A couple of questions. Firstly, just coming back to the retail market assessment and your keenness to sort of carry on tackling some of the issues you uncovered there. Maybe you could give us an idea of what are your priorities for the issues you uncovered that you want to get going on even when the CMA inquiry is underway. And are those changes that you might consider, are they along the lines of what we've already seen under retail market reform? And maybe secondly, related to the question we just had, do you have any concerns that the public is getting a very heated debate, which is characterizing utilities as one larger force, for bad, for want of a better term, rather than a more balanced view of utilities providing a range of benefits, as well as some certain issues and bad behavior you're seeking to correct?
I'll give it a go. So I think certainly there is an active public debate, and the utilities have in some sense been seen occasionally as the forces of darkness. I don't think that's terribly helpful, certainly. But nonetheless, I also think that they need to, in many cases, and perhaps I'm looking more at the competitive end of the market, they do need to up their game. I think I spoke about competition not being as effective as it should be. I also think the enforcement actions we refer to, the customer service, has not been as good as it could be. I think it's really upon incumbent upon utilities, and particularly the management of the utilities, to up their game in this regard, to provide better service, to both, I think, make more clearly to the public, to make the public try and understand more clearly what's driving energy costs, and to convince the public that they're being treated fairly in a way that perhaps they haven't been convinced until now. And so I said I would challenge the companies in that regard. I think Ofgem also has a role, certainly. Ofgem has a role. We think we're trying to bring as much transparency to the market as possible. The SMI was referred to earlier. And we're trying to make sure that they, that, as you said, the companies bring better customer service. But by and large, I think it is true that we're not in a great situation. Customer trust is at a low level. And I spoke at the start about one of the potential side benefits to this EMA investigation would be that it will, we hope, permit in a more technical and a more reasoned way, it then prevents the debate about the structure of the energy industry to proceed in a way that's subject to reasoned analysis rather than perhaps any degree of public hysteria. So we hope that over time that will help. Certainly I do think, however, that in particularly in an area like energy, which is an essential service, you can't have a very long-run situation where there's massive customer distrust. It's just not stable. At some level, the political classes just won't accept it. So in some fashion, trust has to be rebuilt. I think the CMA protest will help. It's also up to other actors, but most of all, it's up to the energy companies to help rebuild trust as well. I might just have to pay
consideration for the other question.
So in terms of things we're doing in the retail market in parallel with the CMA's investigation, no, we don't have anything on the scale of the retail market reforms. I've charged the police, and I think that would be inappropriate given the investigation. But that's not to say we are not doing a number of really important things. One is that we have got a very large program of work aimed at ensuring that consumers can capture the benefits of smart metering, particularly through the form of faster switching, access to advanced services, and tackling some of the empowerment and consumer protection issues associated with smart metering. So that's a very big and important piece of work, which has obviously got a time horizon even beyond the CMA investigation itself, and we will continue to press on with that work. We're also doing, again, really important work on third-party intermediaries and a really important way of facilitating consumer engagement in the market is through switching sites and other intermediary services. And indeed, in that area, we're seeing actually a rather significant degree of innovation coming through, particularly on the back of information technology. And we're really keen to make sure that we do everything we can to ensure that consumers can have trust in those intermediary services, but also that there's nothing blocking those services coming forward and providing access to the market and other services to consumers. And then lastly, one of the big pieces of work we are doing is we think we can do things to address some of the barriers to entry and expansion, which are near term and which are our gift, even whilst the CMA investigation is going on. So we are looking to provide a forum through which smaller suppliers, independent suppliers, entities with different business models can get better access to the regulatory process. We're considering how we might work with government on that and using that as a way of understanding what within the Ofgem rules we could be changing to reduce barriers to entry.
Right, we've pretty well used up our allotted time, and I've detected a bit of a trend towards heading to the door towards the back of the room, so I think we should probably call this to a halt now. If you have further questions, please take the opportunity to speak to the team here now if you want to. If not, two people I should have introduced are Brenda Tanis and Harry Rippon in the front row, and they are your route in to us for questions. We'll pass them on to us and we'll answer them as appropriate. So do feel free to come and ask us more questions if appropriate. Thank you very much.